Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Monday, March 18th. We have public hearings on three bills this morning. Two of our committee members are at an important meeting in Portland this morning, so I apologize that they're not available. It's a wildfire summit or something. Legislative business that was really important for them. We will take the public hearings in the order they're listed on the agenda. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2867.
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2867 comes to us from House Education Committee with a unanimous vote. The bill modifies a requirement for a high school to qualify as a small high school for the purpose of state school fund distribution. In fact, there are a couple of requirements for a high school to qualify as a small high school. One is the school itself should be small, using ADM, average daily membership. And the other one is the school should be in a district, school district, relatively small, and there is ADMW requirement. And this bill changes that ADMW requirement for school district.
Thank you, Representative Rushkie.
Good morning. I will just start by saying that yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, and I'll let you draw your own conclusion on the attendance of the committee. Good morning, Chair Nathanson and esteemed honorable member of the House Committee on Revenue. For the record, my name is E. Werner Reschke. I'm fortunate to be the state representative of House District 56, which represents the people and ideas of Southern Klamath and Lake Counties. Today I bring before you House Bill 2867 for your consideration. This is one of my favorite types of bills because it makes a small, narrow change but will have an important impact on the lives of students. In short, House Bill 2867 changes one number in statute, 8,500 students in a school district to 10,500 in a school district. This number is important because it's the ceiling for the number of students that may be in any one school district in order for a small high school to receive additional funding. Currently, the small high school funding is around $2.5 million and is allocated by the number of students in the program. The change made in this bill from 8,500 to 10,500 does not ask for additional funds. By increasing the number, it does not add any new school districts. And by increasing the number, it does not add any new high schools. What House Bill 2867 does do is it allows Klamath County School District to slowly grow in total population without jeopardizing or negatively impacting all the small high schools that have received funding and wish to continue to receive the funding. When this bill was before the House Committee on Education, there were several students from Klamath County School District who traveled 200 plus miles one way over a snowy pass to testify about this bill. Well, they traveled both ways, but it was snowy, yeah. They were accompanied by several Klamath County School Board members and the superintendent of the Klamath County School District. I'm more than happy to provide you a video link of their testimony. It's quite entertaining. They did a very good job. There were 11 students that just rotated in and out. I was very proud of them. And they are from the rural schools, high schools in our district, not the urban schools in our district that would lose this funding without this change. This bill has bipartisan support in its sponsorship, and I thank you for your considerations and encourage your support.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Reschke? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure. Thank you, Representative Reschke, for being here. I'm not sure it's for you. It might be for Day. Famous last words is it will just have one small impact that we have decided it is going to have.
Right.
So I wonder, what we know about changing this number, is Klamath the only county that would be impacted by this? Are there other school districts? Kind of, do we know that yet? Have we run the numbers on just the change right now and how many districts that would impact?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith-Warner. So right now, Klamath County is the one getting close to 8,500, a little over 8,300. The next one is Lincoln County, about 7,000 ADMW. It's getting about 230 high school corrections, some additional weighted ADMW. The far down the list is about, it's Morrow County, and it is about 3,000 ADMW. And then high school correction of like 220 or so. Yeah. So okay. For any time soon, it's not going to impact other than Klamath County.
Okay. So follow up. So,
yes.
Thank you. And so, and even not just counties, but districts too. It's school districts. So it just seems odd to me that there's not other districts that whose ADMW is between 8,500 and 10,500 that would get brought in if that were the case. Please.
And Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith-Warner, I believe the next closest school district is in Springfield, and it's at 13,000 some odd students. So there's this gap between where the cap is right now at 8,500, and then Springfield's up at the 13,000-ish number. So we tried to pick a number that would allow Klamath County to expand, but not draw in any other school district in the state. And I think ODE is here as well that can verify or validate that. Again, I believe, and so that's why I had Representative Lively's on the bill as well, because I wanted to make sure that he understood what we were doing since he was the nearest school district on the list. Yeah.
There are no other questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
One other person has signed up to testify, Lori Satinspiel.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Board, here in support of 2867, and want to thank Representative Reschke for his work on this. I will clarify a couple of question points. I just wanted to say I was in awe of the students who came from Klamath Falls. They did an awesome job. The school, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. Some of those students had never been to Salem. It was exciting to see them here. They were very good at what they did. On the questions that you had in 327077, there are some dates, and that's where qualifications and who's eligible for this. A school may qualify as a small school under the section only if A, the location of the school has not changed since 1995. The school qualified as a small high school on January 23rd, 2009. And on or after October 29th, 1999, and prior to the 2009, the school was not part of a high school that divided or otherwise reorganized into two or more schools in the same city. So there's very small sideboards for keeping it direct. If this bill isn't passed, the school district could lose approximately $2 million. And what the students did was talk about the programs that they're able to have, these remote high schools, Bonanza, Chiloquin, Gilchrist, Henley, Lost River, and Mazama. And there's a list of, from DECA to drama, FFA, math team, yearbook, that would be lost if we don't get this bill passed. I'd be happy to take questions. And I do have a lifeline in the back, ODE.
Any questions? Thank you for being here. No one else has signed up to testify. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2867, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2978.
you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2978 is a bill that would create an income tax credit. It'd be available for owners or lessees of short-line railroads that complete certified short-line railroad rehabilitation projects. It does specify the amount of the credit to equal either the lesser of $3,500 multiplied by the number of miles of short-line railroad track that taxpayer owns or leases in Oregon, or 50% of the certified short-line railroad rehabilitation costs. The credit would be available in tax years 2020 through 2025, and there is a placeholder piece in the bill right now that would specify the annual limit of the credit. It's not specified at this time, it's just a blank, but there could be an annual limit to the amount of certifications of the credit.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
I'll bring up my report.
And
yes. Made it, I was worried.
Good morning.
Shall I?
Sure.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson.
Other committee members.
Other committee members.
There are too many of us to name.
Emphasis on two.
My name's Katty McHugh, and I represent House District 9 on the South Coast, Coos Beatty Yahats, and I'm here today to support House Bill 2978. House Bill 2978 creates a tax credit, which is modeled after a short-line tax credit, which expired at the end of 2016, a federal short-line credit. As a result of Connect Oregon's funding cuts and the recent lack of a competitive process combined with the federal tax credit's expiration in 2017, short lines lost nearly all local, state, and federal investment in one fell swoop. And I happen to have one such short line in my district, one of 18 total in the state. It's called the Coos Bay Rail Line. And Margaret Barber is here today representing the port, and she'll testify about the details about that particular short line. But I'm here to testify on behalf of all of our short lines and in support of the bill. Short line railroads are different than class ones in a few notable ways. Of course, they're smaller. They have greater deferred maintenance. They have lower revenue streams available to address those maintenance needs. Even if or when Connect Oregon returns to the funding levels and the competitive processes of the past, it really is intended to spur economic development through forward-looking projects. This is an important objective, but it doesn't address the unique deferred maintenance needs of our short line railroads in Oregon. House Bill 2978 matches short line railroads dollar for dollar up to $3,500 per track mile for qualifying investments in three things: rail, ballast, and ties. These railbed maintenance projects improve safety by reducing the potential for derailment. They increase track speeds, which help reduce wait times, traffic congestion at grade crossings, and operational costs, which is very important. By requiring a 50% match as opposed to 30 in the Connect Oregon program, the tax credit program under this bill will leverage more private capital per public dollar than Connect would. It's also important to note that the tax credit under this bill is transferable. This means that Oregon's publicly owned short lines, like the Coos Bay Rail Line and others, can take advantage by making an investment and generating a credit, which can then be transferred to a private entity with a tax liability claim against it. I'm hopeful that providing this credit to public short lines will create cascading economic development opportunities across the state and, of course, at the Port of Coos Bay by incentivizing new customers that will come to these entities because of the condition of the rail lines. A yes vote would advance vital resources to both public and private short line railroads in our state. This is a very critical issue. I was talking to my staff this morning, and they were asking why maintenance and investment in ballast and rail in our short lines has to do with operational costs. And an example I gave them is track speed is really critical. And the more well-maintained your track is, the higher the FRA rates your rail line for speed. And the example I gave them is with the Coos Bay Rail Line. To get to Coos Bay to Eugene, which is what the length of this short line is, if it takes under 8 hours, you can do it with one shift. If it takes more than 8 hours, you have to have two crews, and it has to overnight in some place like Mapleton. So it almost doubles the cost. I mean, so when you think about investment in projects like this, there's a lot of nuance to it. It's about safety, it's about derailment, it's about the condition of the track, but it's also about operational cost. So I just wanted to note that as a conversation we had this morning. I know that Senator Roblin is here. There's a number of people behind me who have a great interest in this. So, and Margaret's here to talk about the details for one specific.
So Arnie Roblin, State Senate District 5, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay, and then in the Valley and Sheridan and Falls City. Chair Nathanson and committee members. it is really an honor to be here and talk about this one. I really didn't have any idea about short lines not that long ago. And then there was a situation in Coos Bay where they were going to sell the line and tear up the track. And we recognized that it would be a disaster for a lot of the companies on the South Coast. And the port stepped forward to take over buying that short line. And they found out that even though they were a port, they had no idea what a rail line was, and they've developed over time to a better understanding and to try to continue to improve it. On Friday, I drove to Pendleton to go to a Ways and Means Committee, and the first people that Senator Hansel introduced me to were some Union County commissioners who had a letter for him that they gave to me because it was about this bill, because they have a short line as well. And they were saying, we are very supportive of this bill, and they gave their senator a little bit of a problem for not having been on it. But so we had a great little conversation, but it reminded me that there are a lot of places around Oregon that have short lines that are an economic driver for them, and they need help because they are expensive to maintain. And like the state does with ODOT, we spend a lot of money on maintaining our roads so that we can tie into this federal network of freeways and highways that they're responsible for. That's the same thing here. These short lines are the highway system for rail in Oregon. The class ones, they are the freeways, and you got to get to the freeways to get your stuff to market, right, whoever and wherever you are. We're that end-of-line provider that gets that makes an economic development in many of these rural areas feasible because you can transport your product cheaper, more efficiently, and with less carbon footprint than you could on trucks and other kinds of things. And we watched when different things have happened with our rail. It's been closed at different times, and the local businesses had to invest millions of dollars in new transportation costs, which they hadn't had to do before when they had to take trucks and put those trucks on the road. And we got to watch the impact of that in downtown Coos Bay as a whole lot more trucks passed through us. They closed a bridge, a company that was building bridges, and there were large pieces of steel that were moving on our highways that weren't there before because they were always on the rail. We need to keep our state rail system, our short line rails, that part of the system that makes it all work, viable. And the only way to do that is to ask for some help from the state to invest in rural communities that are served by these short lines. So I appreciate your willingness to listen to this and look forward to helping in any way I can.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Barber. I'm with the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I'm really happy to be here today to speak in support of this bill. It would have a really significant impact for us. The port owns and operates the Coos Bay Rail Line. It's 134 miles of mainline track. We have a lot of associated infrastructure as well, like 121 bridges and 9 tunnels, just because of the topography of the region requires a lot of that kind of infrastructure. The line is over 100 years old, which means it needs constant and consistent investment in order for it to remain viable for transporting Oregon goods. We have 9 primary shippers that utilize the line, and those shippers employ almost 1,000 people in rural Oregon with family weights jobs. So, and they truly do depend on the rail line as an affordable transportation option. There's also, I know you're aware, a nationwide trucking shortage. So for areas that are rural and remote like us, that's really amplified. So it's having the availability of the transportation as well as managing cost. So I would really encourage your support of this bill. It would make a big difference for us. Thank you.
Yes.
Since we put our rail back because we knew that maintenance was really important, there's a surcharge, and it still exists by every one of the people along the line. And they know they're paying this extra fee just for maintenance. And so, I mean, they are willing to invest. We are willing to take that investment and make changes. And we've done a lot of the work, but as a 100-year-old system, it continues to require more work.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Yes.
I am holding myself back. As I was keenly involved in the acquisition of the Coos Bay Rail Line as a port commissioner when a hedge fund embargoed it, was going to rip up the track and sell it for scrap for $16 million and basically strand our port. And our federal delegation, a number of legislators, our governor, people stood up, our mayors, our county commissioners, our shippers stood up and made this move, which was rather challenging and difficult. But the Surface Transportation Board at the federal level actually ordered Rail America to sell the line to the port, which has happened about five times since, 1887? Mm-hmm. A very, very rare move, and we cherish this piece of infrastructure because it is the lifeblood of a port that is very important to the economy of the South Coast. So I could go on for a very long time, but I shall choose not to. I just wanted to make sure that people understood the importance of this infrastructure. Also, for every rail car that we move, we keep four trucks off our highways. And that's a really important thing when you're talking about the transportation system as a whole. Wear and tear on our highways is very expensive. And for every truck we pull off and put those commodities on a rail car, it's good for the entire system, too. So I think it's, and it also, of course, reduces carbon emissions in the meantime. So just wanted to make note of that. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Rushkin.
And mine's a comment, and you might think I'm the second representative from Coos Bay, but I'm not. I think this port is particularly important in the regards that Terminal 6 up in Portland is having challenges with the new types of ships that are being created. And I think Coos Bay needs to be looked at as our 21st century and 22nd century port. And so any kind of infrastructure we can build at the port or to the port, I think, is critical to keep Oregon facing towards Asia and the Far East.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anything else? Thank you all.
Shalana Butterfield.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mana Butterfield. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rail Users League, or OREL. OREL is an umbrella kind of organization. We have Class 1 rail, so Union Pacific and BNSF. We have a number of short lines. There are 17 short lines throughout Oregon. We have some of the larger ones. We have about five ports that use rail. We have shippers. We have TriMet and passenger rail. We have engineers and logistics managers. We have a whole realm of people. And all of us support House Bill 2978. This bill, if passed, will improve the rail transportation network across the state. It will benefit not only the railroads, but also the shippers that use those railroads and the employees that the shippers employ. There are many jobs supported by freight movement provided by the small railroads across Oregon. Better movement of freight benefits all Oregonians, all Oregonians. Short lines will have a much better ability to plan for the long term. It will help Oregon business and industry stay competitive in the national and global markets. If you look online, you'll see a letter from Lake County Railroad, Goose Lake Railway, and others. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you for your consideration.
Questions? Thank you. Next, we will hear from Mark Mickelson and Don Sile.
Good morning, Chairwoman Nathanson and the two members of the committee. My name is Don Sile, and I am the General Manager of Project Development with Genesee & Wyoming. I live and work here in Salem. I'm here to testify in support of HB 2978. During my 41-year career in the railroad industry, I've worked for both Class 1 and for the short lines. I have been general manager of several short lines, including the Central Oregon Pacific Railroad and the Portland and Western. Both railroads are considered Class 3 short line common carrier for the freight rail system. Collectively, the Portland and Western and the Corp serve 154 customers in the state of Oregon. In the Eugene area, Chairwoman Nathanson, we serve several customers, including Georgia Pacific, Murphy Plywood, Snitzer Steel, specialty laminates, just to name a few. These customers rely on our railroad to keep them connected to the national rail network. Without short line rail service, they would be either forced to truck their shipments, further congesting the I-5 corridor and or other parts of our roadways, or potentially go out of business due to the lack of shipping options. During my time with both properties, one common theme continued to emerge: the need for funding resources to improve the infrastructure so we can better serve our customers. Despite spending $59 million on the Portland and Western and $49 million on the Corp over the last 5 years, there's still plenty of work needed to keep our railroads competitive with trucking and able to seamlessly flow traffic into the Class 1 network. The continuous need for reinvestment is driven by history. Both the Corp and the Portland and Western were cast off from the large companies, the railroads, due to the light traffic density and the lack of profitability. Short lines like the Portland and Western and the Corp survived through economic operations and a focus on providing superior customer service. However, the infrastructure they inherited was so often in need of significant upgrading to handle the modern and more heavier freight cars. HB 2978 will allow the short lines in Oregon to continue to invest in the critical rail infrastructure to support our rural economies safely and efficiently. According to the Oregon Department of Transportation and Rail Study, approximately 35% of the track miles in the state are restricted to 10 miles an hour. And of the same study says 22% of the state short line tracks are not able to support the modern weighted 286,000-pound rail car. This puts Oregon at a disadvantage both for rail efficiency and customer shipping efficiency. The Portland and Western invest approximately 29% of its revenue back into the railroad, along with the Corp, which is approximately the same amount. These numbers are incredibly high because we need to ensure that our railroad is safe and efficient for our customers to ship their goods. Creating a tax credit for the short line rehabilitation and maintenance allows for the short line industry to target the investments that are most needed to support our customers and the Oregon's infrastructure. It will not demand any new administrative resources from the state, in that each short line will be in the best situation to target the new infrastructure spending that the credit would allow. The proposed credit is targeted only for the smaller railroads, those in need of increased infrastructure funding. I would encourage you to support HB 2978. Thank you for your attention.
Good morning. It is on. You can hear me. Okay. My name is Mark Mickelson, and I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and you might wonder what I'm doing out here. I'm a tax lawyer, CPA, And among the things that we do is we work with a number of Class 2 and 3 railroads, originally a railroad based in my home state. And I recently completed serving 6 years in the South Dakota State Legislature, so I should thank you all for the service that you're doing. A couple things to put things in perspective. Why should you consider a subsidy for a short line railroad? And I think you heard the Coos Bay testify that they've got shippers that employ 1,000 people. There are 18 short lines in the state of Oregon, and I would estimate a fair approximation there'd be 15 to 20,000 jobs in the state of Oregon who are reliant on short line rail shipping. The second reason is, as an industry, Class 2 and 3 railroads spend between 25% and 33% of their revenue on track investment. It's a very capital-intensive business. And a statistic that I found particularly interesting is the Class 2 and 3 railroad network has 27% of the track miles in the country and 4% of the revenue. So they've got 27% of the infrastructure, but only 4% of the revenue. They're traditionally rural, lower density rail lines, very important to the geographies that they serve. So I thought I'd address a little bit about why an investment tax credit versus some other form of a subsidy. Importantly to the railroads and to their shippers, the investment tax credit is the railroad spends $2 to get $1 of return. So there's a matching element where the railroad has to make an investment and then get some public help. And it's repeatable. It's available every year, and that matches the reinvestment requirements of the railroad network, which has significant reinvestment requirements every year. The Oregon State rail study estimates to get train speeds up to 40 miles an hour would cost around $150 million at a minimum, and that the deferred maintenance on just the bridges alone on the Class 3 railroad network is about $140 million. Another reason a tax credit has benefit is it's available to every qualifying railroad, and it does not put the state in the position of deciding which railroad should qualify this year and which ones should not. I can tell you they're all in the position of needing help. They all have significant deferred maintenance. And lastly, the tax credit program, traditionally, typically, we've seen it in other states and at the federal level, it costs little to administer. If the railroad has the track miles, if they spend the money on track maintenance activities, it's a matching program, and so it's fairly cost-effective to administer. The second point I wanted to address is why a transfer feature? And you probably are used to seeing transfer features in renewable energy credits or housing credits, those kinds of things. Why is that important to stimulate the desired investment activity in this case? Well, not every railroad's in the same tax position. At Coos Bay, I think there are four railroads total that are publicly owned. The city of Prineville, Wallowa Union, the Coos Bay Railroad, they're not going to have a tax liability. They're owned by taxpayers. Secondly, the track investment needs, those plans are made over a multi-year period. And the decisions for 2019 are being made today. You got to line up your contractors. You've got to line up your labor. That's done at a point in time where you don't know what your tax liability is going to be for the year. And so if there's uncertainty with a railroad's ability to use the tax credit, that would dilute the effectiveness of stimulating the desired additional track investment. And lastly, because of the industry conditions that I mentioned earlier, the heavy reinvestment requirements in track and lower density, many, and I would go so far as to say most industry participants don't earn a tax liability sufficient to allow them to fully utilize the tax credit. And the last point I'd make is the transferable tax credit has worked extremely well at the federal level. And I do know that there are a couple prominent Oregon Senator Wyden and Congressman Blumenauer who have been very strong proponents of the federal credit 45G. So I'd be happy to stand by for questions, and thank you for an opportunity to be here today.
Before we take questions, I'd like to call up Sean Tate. You can stay there if you
we'll
like.
Stay here.
That's fine.
Yep.
And then we'll grill all three of you.
Sounds good. Okay, you didn't say that. Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Sean Tate with JWA Public Affairs. Can everybody hear me okay? With JWA Public Affairs here on behalf of the Albany and Eastern Railroad. Albany and Eastern is a short line railroad based out of Lebanon and serves the manufacturing, agricultural, and wood products industries in Lebanon, Sweet Home, Albany, Crabtree, Mill City, Lyons, and soon Corvallis. We are very supportive of this bill for all the reasons that you've heard already. We also have a letter submitted for the record. But I'd like to reemphasize a couple of points that I think have been made and are equally important. Moving freight off of our roads helps keep our highways in better shape, and as evidenced by the white paper introduced by the Portland and Western Railroad, can actually be looked at as an investment by the state. Increasing rail capacity for our short lines through maintenance and efficiency upgrades removes hundreds of tractor trailer loads from our highways and freeways, which contributes to safety for all users. For the AERC, that's close to 10,000 truck roads annually just on our short line tracks. We move approximately 3 million pounds of freight on our rails each day on only about 60 gallons of diesel. That's a very, very efficient way to move freight around. It's certainly in line, we think, with the state's climate goals. So with that, I would certainly be happy to answer any questions that I can. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Not a question for them, just a comment that Goose Lake Railway, which is in House District 56, the district I serve, also has letters of support on OLIS.
Thank you. Can one of you explain to me what happened with the federal credit?
It's been around since 2005. And 2017 was the last year that it was authorized for. There's very active lobbying efforts on behalf of the association and its supporters to reauthorize the credit at the federal level. It's currently expired. We're hopeful it would get extended at some point, but I guess a little bit unpredictable right now.
So is that part of the transportation package then at the federal level, or was it enacted as a separate piece of legislation, or do you know that? I may know.
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, it's a tax bill, okay, and it moves with a tax package, okay, unfortunately. But it's a spender, you know. There's a cost to it, and so it goes through the House Ways and Means Committee, and that's where it's currently hung up right now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all.
Thank
three.
You. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Marcia Kelly and Robert Sisk.
Okay. Chair Nathanson and committee, I am Robert Sisk with Tax Fairness Oregon, and we speak in opposition to 2978. It is clear that short line railroads are critical to many smaller Oregon cities. However, the bill seems designed for regular maintenance on properties with both private and public owners. Is it not the prices charged customers rather than the general fund that should cover the costs? If the projects are in fact one-time major infrastructure projects, we believe the needs are best evaluated by the regional solutions teams, who would then make decisions about what projects, in competition with other projects in their regions, most deserve public funds, rather than simply an owner's decision to have the public pay up to 50% of their costs as the bill is designed. Further, we question this particular form of subsidy. Grants rather than tax credits are a more rational form of general fund subsidy, especially when these tax credits are transferable as in HB 2978, and especially for publicly owned projects. In testimony in 2018, the owner advocates of a similar bill said in testimony, these tax credits are typically transferred to someone with tax liability. So in their cases, a different form of subsidy would be more rational. Finally, we believe that if the public is going to share in the cost of maintaining these lines, the cost should be property tax breaks, where in the local communities, they support bear at least 55% of the costs. Schools will still lose 40% of their funding statewide, but the local community, rather than the state at large, decides that this is a good use of public funds. It is certainly not clear that any public subsidy is needed. For example, a quick look online found that Genesee and Wyoming, or G&W, is a parent of Willamette and Pacific, and is an international firm with assets in the U.S., Australia, the Middle East, and Europe, with $8 billion in assets and equity of $3.9 billion, G&W enjoyed net income of $557 million in 2017. That's healthy profits for the Short Line Railroad. Thus, we find it difficult to believe that there is any actual need for this business to be pursuing HB 2978, which asks for the general fund to support 50% of their business costs for maintaining and improving their rail lines. Given the budget constraints on tax expenditures and all of the issues raised with subsidizing a specific industry, it is not productive to invest further time in this request since it won't meet our many higher priorities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And I marked both against and neutral on the bill because I really do believe, and we do believe, in maintaining the short line railroads, but we have some concerns. This tax credit is somewhat based on tax credit 45G, which is the U.S. tax credit, that although it expired in 2016, was extended by President Trump when he signed the bipartisan budget bill in February of 2018, making it retroactive to 2017. Our congressperson from Oregon, Earl Blumenauer, has reintroduced the bill. It may change the tax subsidy on the reintroduction, I believe, changes the tax subsidy from 50% down to 30% with a cap at $3,500 per mile on the federal credit. So the concern that we have is doubling up tax credits. With Connect Oregon, we spent over $60 million. We granted over $60 million in funding for short line railroads on $80 million worth of projects. And there was another $93 million on projects that were not necessarily short rail, because as it has been pointed out, Coos Bay is not a short line railway. It's owned by the port. It's a railroad, but it's not, quote, a short line railroad. So there were projects in that $93 million for Morro, Coos Bay, Gilliam, Rainier, Wallowa, and Prineville. And some of them were multiple projects. The concern we also have is the selling of the tax credits by a public entity. And it assumes that you're going to find a private entity that has a tax liability that they're going to want to buy the tax credits. I sit on a public board that was sitting on under $1 million worth of tax credits because we could not find anyone to buy them. And that would be a concern that I have. Direct appropriations to help the railroads would be a much cleaner advantage. And at a minimum, I would ask that you wait to act on this until you see what the status of Congressman Blumenauer's legislation is.
Questions?
Thank you.
Both. Before I close the public hearing on this, I would like to ask Legislative Revenue Office if you could be prepared to provide some information to our committee as a follow-up to some of what we've heard this morning. I'd like to hear more about what happened to the federal credit and the current status of work on the tax credit, on the implications of transferability, and how a tax credit would compare to a direct appropriation or some other type of incentive or subsidy. Anything else? Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2978. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2311.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2311, we do have a dash one amendment in OLUS as well. What the measure will do is it creates an income tax credit for a taxpayer that employs a community college student as an apprentice. The introduced version of the bill does require the apprentice to be age 16 to 30. However, the dash one removes that under 30 requirement. The credit is specified as the lesser of $2,000 or 10% of the wages paid by the taxpayer to the qualifying apprentice, and it would be applicable for tax years 2020 through 2025.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Rep. Smith-Warner, Rep. Reschke. It is delightful to be here on this beautiful post-St. Patrick's Day morning, and I'm here to talk to you this morning about House Bill 2311, and it's a bill that Dr. Matsui and the other folks at Portland Community College and I have been working on for some time. And this bill is about partnerships between business and the community colleges that will encourage the creation of more opportunities for registered apprenticeships. Community colleges, as you know, provide some of the most in-demand, hands-on training available to students at Oregon. And those colleges are able to offer these opportunities thanks to relationships with local employers and businesses that agree to a partnership with one or more schools. The fields of study I'm describing can range from business and administration, manufacturing, construction, agriculture and food production, to healthcare and social services. And many of these apprenticeships and training opportunities are required aspects of a student's program or certificate. That's how integral these experiences are. Community colleges strongly rely on these partnerships to ensure their programs are relevant and valuable for students. This bill addresses the fact that it's very expensive for a business, especially those small and medium-sized businesses that are maybe in more rural communities. It's very expensive for them to train quality employees. You know, productivity with that young student is not necessarily at its highest peak when they begin. So there's a lot of training that needs to be done. And so House Bill 2311 would provide a tax credit for those employers that provide quality training for so many students in Oregon. It's becoming increasingly important to maintain and expand these partnerships as we see decent paying job openings across Oregon, and we don't have enough trained workers to fill those positions. Community colleges and businesses work collaboratively to ensure that these apprenticeships are successful and students are getting exposed to the real skills they will need in the future, not just running errands for the office as I used to do with my apprentices at Tektronix. It's time to acknowledge that we value the training opportunities provided by these local employers. Community colleges create great programs that have highly qualified faculty, but for some CTE fields, they will be restricted in terms of what they can provide on campus. Community colleges rely on these strong partnerships to ensure students are getting the best education possible before they enter the workforce. I do want to clarify, there's one simple amendment to this bill. We had an age cap on it. We want to lift that age cap so that program would be open to anyone. So thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
And before you've concluded your comments, would you please state your name for the record?
Rookie
mistake.
I think
we didn't get it for the recording.
This is State Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48. I apologize.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, and Representative Reschke for the opportunity to appear here today. For the record, my name is Mark Mitsuin, President of Portland Community College. And I also wanted to thank Representative Reardon for sponsoring and supporting HB 2311. This is an important bill for a variety of different reasons. We see HB 2311 as a way to increase both associate degree holders and apprenticeship journey card holders in the state of Oregon. That has that objective has several advantages for the state. This is an earn and learn model that will reduce student debt. And as you know, student debt is a huge concern for all of our students. This also reduces the opportunity cost of going to college because students are working or earning as they're learning. In addition to this, it provides, as Representative Reardon mentioned, an incentive for small to medium-sized businesses, particularly in rural areas, to adopt the apprenticeship model. And finally, it helps to bridge the skills gap and the opportunity gap at the same time. The community college student population is becoming increasingly diverse and representative of the growing diverse communities in the state. Access to apprenticeship and community college education at the same time will again help bridge both the opportunity and skills gap simultaneously. The community college and apprenticeship partnership components embedded in this bill are important for three primary reasons. One is the portability of both a journey card and an applied associate's degree. So if a student were to move out of the region or to move out of their hometown, they would have portability from an academic credential perspective as well as from the journey card perspective. Secondly, the participation with community colleges opens up the related instruction to apprentices who are otherwise eligible for federal financial aid support for the related instruction. In other words, Pell and other federal financial aid can be brought into the equation for the related instruction component of the apprenticeship. And finally, if Senate Bill 3 passes and is signed into law, creating an opportunity for community colleges to offer applied baccalaureate degrees, it creates a pathway for apprentices to a baccalaureate degree. And that apprenticeship experience, OJT, and other elements of related instruction can be incorporated not only to a applied associate's degree, but also to a baccalaureate level credential. We do have a recommendation to consider expansion of the models of earn and learn on-the-job training to other frameworks. One example is cooperative education agreements. PCC has about 1,000 students in co-op, and these are agreements with local employers to consider a spectrum or continuum of earn and learn models for community college students. And of course, the community colleges do have a budget request forward. If that request is fully funded, it creates the basis for being able to expand models like this. Recently, PCC's board signed and approved a resolution regarding revenue, in support of revenue, to support the community college budget request. And that's those are my comments. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for being here.
All right. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Marcia Kelly.
Marcia Kelly, Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Again, this is a tax credit. All tax credits start adding up and they start impacting the revenue that could be otherwise utilized by community colleges, the education system, and all of the other needs of Oregon. Before you solve a problem with a tax credit, you can maybe see that the tax credit might not be needed. as a small business person, I provided on-the-job skills to people from the community college as part of their credit. I employed some of the people after that program. It was not a high-paying job, but it was something that they wanted to be involved in. And I accepted the responsibility of having them in my office making, doing the work, you know, and having the potential of errors. But I thought that it was my responsibility as a small business person to help in the educational system, and I certainly didn't get a tax credit. And I think that you can look at other ways of doing an apprenticeship program other than a tax credit, which if in the aggregate starts affecting the amount of money the state has, then it affects the amount of money that the community colleges get in their appropriations, which then affects their need to raise the tuition. So a tax credit is not necessarily the only way that you could approach this problem.
Questions? Thank you. No one else has signed up to testify on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2311. There's no other business before us today. We are adjourned.